And it is Afternoon Classics here on FM 91. I'm Brad Cresswell, and I have the great pleasure of welcoming four different members of Toledo Opera's La Traviata here in the studio. Before I welcome and introduce each of them, I do want to mention that Toledo Opera is presenting Giuseppe Verdi's La Traviata. It's happening Friday at 7:30 p.m. That's April 22nd. Also Sunday afternoon, April 24th at 2 p.m., all those performances at the Valentine Theater in downtown Toledo. This is the first time in 10 years that actually La Traviata has been performed at Toledo Opera, and it's a wonderful, wonderful way to celebrate the joy and the magic of the human voice in opera, as well to celebrate kind of the emergence from the pandemic that's been going on over the past couple of years. Now, to my guests who are here in the studio, our Violetta for La Traviata, that would be Catherine Lewick. Welcome, Catherine.
Thanks for having me back.
Glad to have you, as well as Zach Borchewski, who is your Alfredo, your love interest on stage, also off stage, but we'll talk about that a little bit more. Welcome, Zach.
That's me. Nice to be here.
We also have the baritone, Malcolm McKenzie, who's performing the role of Germont. Now, you are Zach's father in this opera. Welcome to you as well.
Indeed, thank you.
We also have the esteemed conductor, Joseph Colinari, who is conducting this wonderful opera, La Traviata. Welcome to you.
Thank you, Brad.
Okay, is there anybody else I need to welcome? I think I've welcomed everybody into the studio today. So we're going to talk about La Traviata. First, I want to point out, Katie, that this is your first Violetta, yeah?
Indeed.
What drove you to conquer this role?
Oh, my goodness. This has been a long time in the making. There have been a number of times in my career that people have approached me about singing this role. And it's kind of interesting because I turned five of them down before I took this one for various reasons. You know, it was just kind of something that was a little off about each of the opportunities. And I felt like with this role especially, because it's just been a dream role of mine ever since I became a soprano, which was actually not that long ago, but that's a different story. I have been singing so much Queen of the Night, and it's such a departure from this role is such a departure from singing Queen all the time. I needed to conquer this role at a place that I felt safe, at a place that I feel surrounded by support, and in a traditional way. That was also an important thing to me. So I'm excited that I'm working with Maestro Colinari, who I worked with at Glimmerglass a number of years ago. So I know that he, he's giving me a foundation with this role that is, it's a very important thing. You know, you don't want to, I've done other role debuts where the production or the thought towards it is a little avant-garde. And yeah. There's a place and a time for that, of course. But for my first Violetta, I really wanted a place of tradition.
Yeah. Well, you found it in Toledo. You found a lot of things in Toledo, including your husband, Zach Borchewski, who is singing opposite you in this opera. I wonder if for, you know, old time's sake, you can just recount your getting together here in Toledo and, you know, a few operas and a couple of kids later, here we are.
Indeed.
The last time that we sang an opera together on stage was, in fact, 2015 here in Toledo. We sang Lucia di Lammermoor together.
Yeah.
And that was happened to be the time that we fell in love. Because
just so happens
we had met each other a couple years before, but we never really
in Verona, the city of love.
It's true, but we only talked here and there. But when we did this production of Lucia together, we fell in love, and lo and behold, just a few short years later, along came marriage and two kids, and no operas sung together. And that whole time, we've sung a couple of recitals together, we've sung a few concerts together, no operas until this very production of La Traviata.
We were supposed to do two Rigolettos together. We were both making our double debuts.
Speaking of the pandemic.
We were. He was singing Duke. I was singing Gilda. And both of them were canceled. It was at the very beginning of the pandemic. So that was a major disappointment.
I remember we talked about some of this in the Zoom interview that we did a while back when you came and sang the gala, right, for Toledo Opera. So, you know, we've had the pleasure of hearing you both sing and having you here on the stage, even though that one performance was canceled from the pandemic. It's great to have you both back. Now, Malcolm, have you sung at Toledo Opera before, or have you been here before?
No, this is my first time. I'm enjoying myself, and also, as I always do with Traviata, it's one of my favorite favorite roles to perform. So it's a pleasure all around.
Now, tell me a little bit of where you're from, what your background is.
I'm a Californian. I'm from California. I'm actually a fourth generation Californian, so I'm
you
pretty ensconced.
You said that like it was a bad thing.
I love where I'm from. I do tend to sing more in the West because I've also got children, although they're now grown and gone, so maybe I'll be out here more. But you know, it's my first time at Toledo Opera. I'm looking forward to it. Like I say, it's
your first time in Toledo?
My first time in Toledo, actually. Yeah.
Well, be warned, this is a city of love, so, you know.
I should have had my wife come with me there. Yeah.
Venice is, you know, pales in comparison next to Toledo. Well, let's check in with you, Maestro Culinary. We've sort of saved you for the end. Mm-hmm. You've been here before. I want to welcome you back.
Actually, I have not.
Oh, you have not? Okay.
This is my debut at Toledo.
I must have you mixed up with somebody else.
I don't know, but yeah, no, it's my first visit. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, now people won't forget that it's your first visit. Fantastic. Definitely. We know that I won't forget after this. So you're making your debut, but you've conducted this opera before, obviously.
Many, many times. Yeah. I've been around the block with Traviata about 200 times, I would say.
Wow. Yeah. Well, then it's a good pairing between you and Catherine Lewick, her learning and starting this role and trusting it to you, her first interpretation of it. I mean, what is that responsibility like? What is that dynamic like between the two of you?
Wow. Well, it's because we already have a little history with Candide at the Glimmerglass Festival a couple of years ago. So, you know, we have a kind of established working relationship, which I think is really great. And then I was very excited when I was asked to come here to do this, and it was going to be Katie's first one. And so, you know, every conductor takes a different kind of approach to the piece, but, you know, mine is very much singer-oriented because that's where Verdi was in this middle period at this point. So we've been talking a lot about interpretation of the role, the kind of types of vocal colors we can use. Katie brings a lot of great instincts to the table already, having studied the part. She comes, you know, with the part completely learned. And then we talk about other ways maybe to make a phrasing, or she might come to me and say, hey, you know, is there another way we might be able to make this phrase or arc that kind of line? And so we've been in a very happy process now of discovering all of that. And it's great fun because that's really the conductor and singer need to link very closely together to be able to do something that's really special. And I think that's what we'll have here.
Now, I've got a recording, Katie, of you singing the showpiece, the show-stopping aria, Sempre Libera, which, you know, is really a tour de force for any soprano to sing. I wonder if you could, because I want to listen to this so we can get in the Traviata frame of mind. Tell us a little bit about this aria. Put it in context for us, kind of introduce it for us. And is this something that you sang before, or did you work on the aria as part of learning the role?
I really didn't start working on any of the role until I knew that I had one in my sights. So I had really lightly worked on the aria a number of years ago and then put it away because I thought this is just not quite this. That's not where I am yet. And then I took it back out when Toledo asked me to do this role. And I recorded it. This is actually the recording that you're going to play. It was actually recorded 6 weeks after the birth of my son, who is now 9 months old. So this was not that long ago. But the aria comes at the end of Act One, after she's what she thinks is her first meeting with Alfredo. But of course, he's been coming to her bedside. She's been ill and pretty much unconscious. So she doesn't know that he's been visiting every day. But he has just professed his love to her, and this has comes as a great shock to her because the world that she lives in, you know, love, to use that term, is really almost for show. It's not a deep, you know, when you say, I'm in love with this person. He says, I'm in love with you. And she's a courtesan. She, you know, if you think of sort of modern film adaptations of this story, Nicole Kidman as the role of Violetta in Moulin Rouge, which Zach showed me actually several years ago. It was one of the first movies that we watched together as a couple. And it kind of furthered my obsession with this opera and this role, because she is so cool. She is so wise to the world, even though she's quite young, because it's her job to be that way. You know, these women were known for their wit and their knowledge of the goings on of society, and men would want to have different kinds of conversations with these women than they would with their wives or their sisters or their mothers. So these women were expected to be able to speak with men as equals, which is a very different thing than now. Of course, that's how we all are now. So Alfredo has professed his actual love to her, and I think it kind of takes her aback. She's like, well, that's new. Nobody's ever said that to me. You know, people have wanted me around them for other reasons, but certainly not actual love. And of course, she also knows that she's gravely ill. So it kind of comes at this not so opportune time. It's sort of like, I always feel like, well, couldn't you have shown up 10 years ago? That would have been better. Well, maybe not 10 years, but. So he's professed his love, and she has this very contemplative moment before Sempre Libera, where she says, is this the thing that I've been waiting for all my life? I didn't even really know that I was waiting for this, but suddenly it seems like the most important thing. And then right before Sempre Libera, she says, oh, forget it. Nope. Like, that's not that I, full stop. That's not what life is about. That's not what my life is about. It's all, it's folly. It's, you know, we live for pleasure. That's what we just have to do.
Yeah. We should say, you know, Sempre Libera is Italian, obviously, but it translates as always free. And, you know, Toledo Opera did a really interesting talk about La Traviata. And one of the issues that they addressed, which I thought was really interesting, was how, you know, you couldn't profess your love in the way that we do nowadays because of social mores and what have you. You were restricted by that. And it draws an analogy between how people approached romantic love in the 21st century with the pandemic and how that was sort of putting the shackles on everybody as well. It's an interesting thought. But it's obvious that you put a lot of thought into this character. And we've been talking about this aria, but we should listen to it. I want to just play it here, and I'll take your microphones out, but we'll listen to it together, and then we can talk about it afterwards. Of course, you're here, so, you know, we're going to talk about how great it is, right? No, I have listened to it, and I can tell you that it's pretty great.
I think it's worth saying that the I think that sort of undercurrent, you talked about how the translation, the direct translation of Sempre Libera is always free. Mm-hmm. And yet the way that I interpret it is the opposite of that. She is trying to convince herself that that's the way to live, but actually what she wants is the opposite. She'd rather belong to Alfredo.
Nice. Okay. This is Catherine Lewick singing the role of Violetta, the aria Sempre Libera, recorded from the luncheon at the Metropolitan Opera for the Guild Luncheon. And the pianist here is Craig Ketter, music by Giuseppe Verdi here on FM 91. So we can applaud now. Woo! Because we need to definitely applaud you for that. I mean, that was just fantastic. A lot of people say, you know, the role of Violetta takes several different sopranos, and all of them are on display in that particular aria that you just sang. I mean, what was the process for you? Is this the kind of thing you have to get into your voice, or did you find a proclivity for it from the beginning? I mean, what's the process of getting to where it is now?
Well, like I said, I have been singing a lot of Queen and also a lot of just my career thus far, although I've done some Italian repertoire, has been heavily Mozart and Handel oriented, which I adore. I adore singing Handel, and I mean, Mozart is my boyfriend. I love him. but I knew going into this that singing Violetta was going to require me to access a different set of colors. And instead of trying to identify those with adjectives, I instead tried to link it more towards what she was feeling and what she was going through. So, what I've been trying to find is a more vulnerable sound than I would use with Queen of the Night. a more honest sound, a more genuine sound. And I am very, very lucky that my teacher of a long time, over a decade, Diana Soeiro, she's one of the greatest violettas in the history of this role. She sang, I think, nearly 400 of them in her career. So she knows a lot about this role. And I had three very, very long, in-depth work sessions with her for each of the acts. Mm. And, of course, it's interesting because you said that this, you know, it almost requires two different or several different types of sopranos. And actually, Maestro and I were talking about that the other day, that especially like this, the first act really kind of is... That's kind of my wheelhouse, the coloratura stuff that you just heard. That's the stuff I'm used to doing. When you get to Act Two, the Amami Ofredo moment, which personally for me feels like climbing Everest. The weight of the voice has to change. The breath support has to change. And to sing such an emotionally heated and open, vulnerable, genuine moment for her where she's just, you know, feeling all of the feelings. We say to our three and a half year old now, like, you're having a lot of big feelings. Violetta's having a lot of big feelings in this moment. And to sing it straight at my actual, the love of my life, to sing it to his face, I still haven't quite, even in the rehearsal process, found the emotional strength to really dive into that with complete openness and acceptance.
Yeah.
So that's going to be my job this week.
It's Monday. We've got 4 days left.
But the emotional journey that you have talked about and traced as far as, you know, Violetta really having these feelings of love from the very beginning. And it puts Sempre Libera in a new light, but it also puts everything else that you sing in a new light and culminating, you know, like in the duet material that you have. I think it's really interesting. And so much of that comes through, I think, in what you're talking about. And certainly it'll come through in your singing. Now, Maestro, are you and Katie sort of on the same page with all of this as far as her interpretation goes?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And you're so right about the two different voices of Violetta, because the first act, really, it's lyric coloratura writing. As soon as you get to Act Two, the big duet with Germont, Dite la Giovine, it's all middle voice. It's all lyric kind of singing. Even the final aria, Dio del Passato, also another lyric piece, doesn't go very high.
No.
Just A's, but still, I mean, you know, they have to be, you know, what the Italians call.
That's soprano number two.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Fil di voce, you know, a thread of voice, because, you know, Verdi is coloring her in a way and writing for the voice. And, you know, it's a woman who's dying at the, you know, at the end of her life. And, you know, what kind of a sound is that? What kind of expression is that? So really it's multiple, it's a split personality kind of role in that way, which makes it difficult. And therefore the role is not for every soprano, but we're very lucky we have Katie with us, you know, who can do all of these colors and all of these parts of the voice work individually and then also as a unity, I think, because it's still one person, you know what I mean? And that's a very special thing. But it's a very, very special role of Verdi for sure.
Yeah. And Toledo audiences, you know, get the benefit of seeing you do this and do this for the first time. You know, it's a wonderful opportunity for all of us to enjoy and appreciate the opera. Now, let's talk with the father and son here. You guys have been sitting there very patiently while I talk with your colleagues. But Zach Borchewski is playing the love interest, obviously. Alfredo is the name of the character. And Germont is played by you, Malcolm. You are the father. And you sort of represent, you know, society. You represent everything that gets in their way. But there's still something there, you know. Can you talk a little bit about your feelings about this role and this character, because this is somebody you've done before. You've sung this role before, so you, I'm sure, have formulated some thoughts and ideas about where he's coming from.
Yeah, I think actually this is, I think, my most performed role. I think I've figured that out in the last couple of weeks. I'm trying to remember, but this role is particularly meaningful to me. I'm a father of two daughters, and there's a thing in Verdi where he lost his children at very young ages, and throughout the rest of his career, and he wrote until he was 88 or whatever, he created these relationships, these father-daughter relationships in all of his pieces, essentially. And I love that connection, even though he was reaching for it in his real life. He didn't really have it, but he was reaching for it. And this particular relationship in this opera, it's a father-daughter relationship and a father-son relationship, in that I am, of course, the father of Alfredo, and I'm looking out for him. And in doing so, I'm looking out for his actual daughter as well, to try and remove the shame that this relationship with Violetta has brought on the family so that she can get married. That's the practical side of it. But the emotional side of it, and what happens in this fantastic duet that we were just talking about in the second act, is he comes to Violetta's country house to basically break them up. And he walks into the scene thinking that he's going to be dealing with, well, a courtesan, essentially a harlot, shall we say. And he leaves the scene with a new daughter. He, in this scene, the longest, as you've pointed out, Maestro, right, the longest duet in Verdi, he is convinced not only that she's not what he thought she was, but rather she is actually someone that he needs to protect. And we see that later on in the opera, where he compromises his entire position with regard to his other daughter's marriage and everything, defending her. And in the end, gives in to their relationship and endorses their relationship, albeit too late.
Yeah.
But it's a fantastic transformation that very few, I think, stage characters of any type get to go through, where we have this hardened individual at the beginning who's all about social norms and all about his family's honor, which he brings up absolutely directly in the aria with his son. If you have any honor left, you know, and yet, the voice of honor. But what he actually does is he takes on this character of Violetta, and he embraces her as a daughter. She asks, and he does. Mm-hmm. It's in the score. I've had directors tell me, well, no, they wouldn't really do that. Well, no, it's right there. It's right there. And he begins to, at that point, she convinces him in, well, how long is that duet, 12 minutes long? In 12 minutes, he goes from where he starts out, and then by 12 minutes later, he's defending her like she's his own daughter.
But in opera time, that's a long time.
It is a long time. Yes, of course, yeah. It
feels like about 3 hours.
As the father of two grown daughters, I have two out-of-the-house daughters, this particular portion of this opera, and I guess by extension the entire opera, has come to be more and more meaningful. When I first did this opera, I think my eldest was 2, I think, when I first did when I first did this. And so I kind of had an idea of what was in Verdi's
wasn't quite out of the house yet.
No. But now they're both grown and off, and I find my affinity to this character has only grown with time. And I don't know how many other parts are like that. I don't know. I mean, it's so you grow into it and it becomes part of you. And as a result, I'm so pleased to be sharing Katie's first one with her, because it's, you only get to sing your first Traviata once, and it's a pleasure, and to be part of that, it's just a pleasure. So
yeah, that's great. I feel like we need to applaud again for that.
And but there's a phenomenal complexity too. You mentioned Germont and Violette. That's a very, by Verdi's middle period, which this falls in.
So
if you
great.
Compare this to one of the early father-daughter operas like Nabucco, Abigail and Nabucco, this is very, you know, black and white. You know, a daughter who does not do well by her father, and the father rejects her, and she dies mad at the end.
Right. And Aida as well. You can start listing them off. It's amazing. This is the one that I you know, I really love to hold on
it's
to.
It's very complex. Well,
the only one that, that we have to regret, though, is Verdi wanted to set Shakespeare's King Lear, would have been called Re Lear in Italian. And there were sketches that were done, but if we have to have one regret with Verdi, it's that the greatest of all the father-daughter relationships of Lear and Cordelia never got composed.
Never got composed.
What would that have looked like?
Well, everything that we've said thus far speaks to the fact that it's such a rich drama, so much going on psychologically, but all of it so beautifully represented in the music as well. And, you know, that's why it's still around 150 plus years later. But really watching this opera, even in Italian with the super titles, I mean, you're gripped by the whole drama of the thing. And you also have the benefit of listening to these lovely melodies, many of which belong not only to you two, but also to Zach, who hasn't really had a chance to talk yet. I want to hand the floor over to you, Zach, a little bit and hear about your character. But I'm also curious for you to talk more about, you know, the fact that the two of you have gone off to perform an opera together in the same city, in the same place. I mean, I know during the pandemic you were often in the same place as well, but this is to be working again. How is it feeling for you at this point?
Well, it's great. I remember, I think when we came, when we were in the car on the way home from our first rehearsal together, Katie looked at me and she was like, this is fun. Remember this? We used to do this all the time.
Yeah.
That's where we fell in love, was in the car.
Yes, we...
It's actually more than at rehearsals, it was in the car.
Okay, well, I want to hear this story. No. Was that a rental car? Or
We drove to and from the rehearsals a few times in Charlotte and Toledo.
Yeah, it was a double production between...
We were doing Lucia. But yeah, so this role, I mean, I've done this role probably the most of any other role I've done. Probably not as many times as Malcolm, but... I had a lot of performances in England when I did it at the Glyndebourne Festival because they did it all, both at the festival and on the tour. And the tour has a ton of performances in a lot of different cities. So I've done it quite a few times now. And the thing that I think was too present in my previous interpretations that I think I'm subsuming a little bit more is the nerdiness of Alfredo. I think he is... Because
he's a tenor after
all. Well, we're putting him in this socially awkward place. He is an outsider in the Parisian society of high courtesan. We've talked about how he's probably Malcolm, probably Jean-Malpère has made some money in a middle class way, and so he's well off now, but he's not titled. Alfredo's the only character in the party scene who's not titled, who's a man. So he is an outsider, and he's unfamiliar with what's going on. But he's not necessarily personally very awkward and nerdy. And that several of the productions that I've been in so far have been like creating Alfredo as a borderline sort of autistic character. And I just think it you know, I'm glad to be in a place where we can make it a little bit more sensible that Violetta falls in love with him. Because it's not to say that, you know, autistic people can't be fallen in love with, but to explain the initial immediate attraction and the depth of feeling that comes right away out of him. I don't know. I think it makes more sense if he is a sort of normal person in the world who just is struck by love and driven to produce these melodies that you're talking about that come back in her aria after our initial duet, when I initially sort of declare the importance of love and how I'm in love. That comes back with her. And yeah, the wonderful thing about Verdi and the wonderful thing about opera in general is the imbuing of emotion through nonverbal means. In this case, fantastic melodies. In many other cases, fantastic harmonies. In many other cases, you know, disharmony, dissonance. That's what opera's all about. And it's a wonderful privilege to be able to sing it every time.
Now, I have a couple. One is a comment and one is a question. The comment was, you put me in mind of this when you were talking about things that were important in society back at the time. So if you loved Bridgerton, you'll love Traviata,
yes,
right?
Come on.
That's one thing.
Outlander, too.
And yeah, all of those period dramas. I mean, Traviata, you talked, Katie, about this being a very traditional kind of production. Well, it's a period drama, really, with fantastic music, a wonderful opportunity. The other thing I was going to ask, the whole enchilada, as they say, is there. Now, let me ask you, Zach and Katie, you know, you're a married couple. You have this obviously personal relationship, but how do you interact professionally? I mean, do you sort of bounce ideas and thoughts off of each other, or do you just say, you know, you get in the car and that's it, no more shop talk until the next day? I mean, how does that work for
you? When I learned this opera for the first time, it was at school at the Academy of Vocal Arts in Philadelphia. And I learned it from the maestro Makatsouris there, who is very old school and very relentless in his attention to detail. And so when I've gone through all these various different productions of it, I've always had him in my mind. And thankfully, this past few months in January, I guess, he was free enough to give some time to coach Katie on it as well. So we went to Philadelphia and coached it together, and we went through the whole opera with him on 3 days. And you can talk about whether you liked it. I thought it was good.
Yeah, well, I mean, I was talking earlier about how it was really important to me to work with sort of a traditional crowd, and I feel really fortunate that Maestro Culinary agreed to do this, and Mark Forsat is also a traditionalist when it comes to staging. And of course, he doesn't like that word. He doesn't like the word staging. He likes it to be organically grown, and to be surrounded on either side here, even in the studio, with my husband Zach on one side and Malcolm on the other side. I have surrounded myself either by choice or by other people's choices with a whole bunch of people who have done this piece so many times they've lost count. And I think that that is the best possible way for me to debut an iconic role such as this, that, and not just iconic, but very, it's very important. It's a very important role in the repertoire of opera. Mm-hmm. And I hope that I sing many, many more of them. And I wanted to be sure, you know, like you said, you only debut your first Traviata once. Well, also, you only learn it for the first time once. And I think everybody who has ever, I'm speaking to the young singers out there, anybody who is learning arias for the first time in their school setting, you're going to carry those habits that you're creating now throughout your career. You know, I learned Regnava nel silenzio from Lucia di Lammermoor in college. It was actually one of the first soprano arias that I worked seriously on. And when I finally debuted that role in 2015, I found that the habits that I had made in that one aria were so frustrating because I was trying to break these bad habits that I'd made as a student when I learned that aria, compared to Il Dolce Suono, which is the mad scene at the end. It actually was so much like fundamentally easier for me to sing than the aria, which should in theory be easier than the mad scene at the end of the opera. So that was one of the major reasons that I didn't want to do this role too soon. And I wanted to surround myself with the right people when I was learning it because I want to do it right. So Maestro Culinary and Maestro Makatsouris, both of them have brought that same flavor, that come scritto, how it's written, what is on the page. Just yesterday, Maestro Culinary just kind of saunters into our little moment of kind of hashing out this, you know, where are you going to be and where am I going to be and, you know, all this stuff. And Maestro comes up and very quietly with the score, just kind of leans over to both of us and says, "It's really interesting. You know, this is not a mountain I'm going to die on. This is these quarter notes and these eighth notes here that I'm seeing on the page, but I'm just seeing that, you know, every time you ask a question, it's with an eighth note, and when you answer the question, it's with a quarter note. Just something to think about." That level of detail. Absolutely. In a score like this can really elevate the quality of the performance. And I'm just so, so, so lucky to be surrounded by people who will remind me of those things and point those things out because it will make a big difference.
Mm-hmm. That's the number one thing I took away from my education at AVA, I think, and also at Yale. It's just the idea that when you pay that level of attention to the score, it does get better because you can learn in an academic setting that all the dates are important, all the notes, all the note values, all the rhythms are important and okay, but like I'll mess it up. But when you like experience it with world-class musicians, as I did when I was in advanced levels of school, that's when you figure out that when you do all those details correctly, it is the best. And not only is it the best, but anyone can tell that it's the best. You don't have to be a graduate level student in opera to appreciate the difference in quality between somebody who's paid attention to the detail and has motivated every detail of the music with the specific intention, than somebody who's just sort of singing along. You know, the difference there is apparent to the audience being, you know, people that are just coming in to see the show. They don't have the score memorized. They don't have photographic memories. They're not there. Oh, that eighth note is correct. No, the eighth note is correct because it makes sense in the context of the piece and the intention is there. And that's what it's all about.
Well, and you're speaking a little bit to the point that I wanted to make after Katie was talking. It's sort of a two-way street. You know, you have to have somebody who's capable of guiding you in that direction, but you also have to have the goods and the ability to follow those instructions and to participate in that process. And I think all of you obviously have all of those qualities. And, you know, who benefits? But raise my hand here, as well as everybody who goes to see the show. It's a wonderful, wonderful opera, and I predict that it's going to be wonderfully performed. I should mention this is happening at the Valentine Theater in downtown Toledo. It's Friday, 7:30 p.m., also Sunday afternoon at 2 p.m., and you can get tickets at toledoopera.org, or you can call up. Let's do an experiment, see if I remember the phone number right. It's 419-255-SING, right? Yeah, I'm getting a thumbs up from your publicity person in the corner. 419-255-SING. I don't know what the digits are for SING, so I'm just going to say SING. And speaking of singing, when you were sort of imitating Maestro Colinari, I was getting flashbacks of working with him many, 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 many years ago with the New York City Opera on tour.
Absolutely, right.
And
right.
We did Carmen. We actually sang Carmen in the University Musical Society up in Ann Arbor.
That's which, right.
You know, can hear this radio broadcast. So we've come full circle.
Absolutely.
Now I can die a happy man.
Me too. Right? It's wonderful when those things come back again.
Yeah.
You don't die at the end of that opera. It's the
other. Yeah. The soprano. We don't want to jinx anything, though. Although you die in this opera too. So,
true.
Yeah.
True. And I wanted to, because my husband didn't answer the question. I wanted to answer the question. When we get in the car, no, we don't leave it behind. We're talking about it all the way home.
Oh,
he's giving me notes. We're tossing stuff back and forth. But then it does have to end as soon as we walk into the house because we have a 3.5-year-old and a 9-month-old. And so it becomes all about the kids as soon as we go home.
Well, I was going to tell the story about how we went through it. And I tried to play the piano for you several times at our home studio.
Which I very much appreciated.
Which was a disaster.
But. And he also sang Malcolm's Heart in the...
Yes, I did sing your duet a lot.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. To get myself back up to tenor range.
That's great when you can interact like that and get the roles prepared together.
I feel really fortunate that I had him as my in-home coach for many, many months. I have to say, over a year I was working on this role. And
overstating.
Yeah.
It was very useful.
Before I let you go, I just want to do a shout out to Mark Verzot because we haven't talked about him very much, but he's the director of the show. Have you all worked with Mark before? Because he's just a fantastic director.
Mark was my professor at Yale.
And
I have worked on my very first fully staged opera with orchestra with him, La Boheme. We did Fledermaus as well, but he was also the acting coach there. So we had acting sessions every week and I really admire what he brings to the stage because he himself has started straight acting recently. He's doing a lot of sort of Shakespeare and other straight theater plays. And he brings a real sort of theatrical sensibility, but he knows opera so well. Like he knows the score at least as well as any of us. He has it all memorized. He doesn't
talk about attention to detail.
Yeah, he doesn't look at it.
Yeah.
He's got it all in his brain, and that's what helps. I mean, I've worked with lots of opera directors who are doing it for the first time or come from straight theater or whatever, but he comes from straight theater but appreciates that opera directing is by nature a different art form, because you can't do the same stuff you can do in straight theater. At the same time, you can bring the sensibility of acting and those are also important things to bring, but there are elements that you have to consider in opera that you don't have to consider as much in straight theater, and he's cognizant of that, and he's really great to work with for that reason.
And he understands, too, that in the straight theater, you know, you're presented with a text. It can be delivered at any pitch of voice. It can be delivered virtually at any speed. And, of course, these are things that the composer has already determined for us. You know, here's the speed has to fall in the tempo in this parameter. You know, these voices sing these lines and this color, and you know, you have a limitations there. And when the director understands that well, he can then open new doors, which I think Mark is doing so beautifully. Yeah.
This is my first time working with Mark, but I find him to be just the absolute perfect combination of director in charge. This is what I want. This is what I want to see. Mm-hmm. And also being so open to the interpretation that the artists bring to it.
Collaborative.
It's really, really lovely to work with
It's him. A wonderful thing to work with a director on a piece that you think you know inside out. And then he finds something new for you.
You learn things.
Well, it sounds like that's something that Mark Frizzlot and your maestro, Joseph Culinary, have in common, in that they not only support you, but they also introduce you to new and exciting things.
And with Verdi, we have the great musical operatic gift. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention a great quote by the Italian poet Gabriele D'Annunzio, who wrote a sort of a paean when Verdi died, and a wonderful long sort of poem on the loss that Italian culture was facing. And he ended it with a line, something to the effect of "Pianse ed amò per tutti." He wept and he loved for us all.
Yeah.
And that, to me, that's Verdi in a sentence.
Well, I think this performance will be definitely a testament to the genius of Giuseppe Verdi. The opera is La Traviata. It's happening Friday at 7:30 p.m., Sunday afternoon at 2 p.m. at the Valentine Theater. This is April 22nd and 24th. You can find more information on our website, that is at toledoopera.org, or call the box office, 419-255-SING, easy to remember. We've been talking today with three cast members and the conductor of the opera. I want to thank Catherine Lewick, Zach Borchevsky, Malcolm McKenzie, and our maestro, Joseph Culinary. Thanks so much for talking with us and lending some insight, some sort of a backstage pass as to what's going on with the production of this opera. Really appreciate that. And looking forward to seeing you on the stage at the Valentine.
Let's do it.
Can't wait.